This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Journey Mage, Book 6 of the Spellmonger series, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Part 1. Bedesh and Berod. Chapter 1. Occasions of State. The novelty of state occasions had worn off. Call it an axiom of power, but the first really large state ceremony you attend, like the first time you have sex, fills you with awe at the grandeur and pageantry. You are so impressed by the spectacle, which are designed to impress, and the importance of the occasion that you are usually blind to the bored-looking people in the fancy robes standing around the head of the ceremony. You naturally feel that they are as invested in the importance of the occasion as you are, if not much more so, as they are important, and this is an important occasion. The truth is, most of them are bored as hell. Having been one of the important people in fancy robes standing on the dais for a few years now, I've learned a few things. For example, I knew that if the particular occasion did not directly concern your interests, I can assure you that despite the sublime smile I'd learned to plaster on my face, like the other members of the court, I wasn't nearly as charmed by the proceedings as I pretended. I was there merely to be important, in my fancy clothes, and lend my importance to that of the ceremony. I wasn't here for magic. I could have sent a stand-in, and no one in the audience would have had the slightest idea. This particular occasion had little to do with me or my interest. The marriage of the handsome young prince Tavard to his beautiful but utterly vapid Rhaemeran bride Armandra. As weddings go, it was about average. As state occasions go, it was a glorious celebration of the ruling house and required all important people of the court to be there to demonstrate that fact. The great hall of the royal castle was packed, sweaty bodies in silken robes as far as the eye could see. The high priestess of Trigg was droning on about the sanctity of marriage to the smart-looking young couple in the majestic light of a great stained-glass window overhead, and I was bored near to tears. Thankfully, I wasn't resigned to hearing a husband's sacred duties to his wife, under the auspices of the Holy Mother, spelled out yet again, as I was lucky enough to be a mage, and magi have spells to avoid that sort of thing. I used one to reach out mind to mind to Lady Pentandra, who was only 6 rows away from the stage, packed in with a bunch of barons and abbots. I could barely see her from where I was, but with magic I could speak to her across the crowded room as easily as whispering in her ear. Nor was it just idle chatter, I convinced myself. Something had caught my otherwise useless attention.
Penny? Who is that? Min, there are 1,000 people in this hall. You're going to have to be more specific.
Sorry. 3rd row back. On the left. Young man, about 15, black hair, blue velvet tunic. He's standing next to that old priest. He looks familiar. He keeps glaring at the groom, looking sad and angry.
Oh, that's... Min, you don't know?
I've been... No, I don't know.
Min, that's Anguin. Heir to what's left of Alshar.
Duke Glenguin, son. I thought his name was Anguin.
That's your funny Riverlands accent, hearing the funny Alshari accent incorrectly, and they're kind of touchy about how you pronounce it.
Why? I asked. Ordinarily, Penny's lectures were something I tried to avoid, but my legs were starting to cramp and I was bored. Bits of historical gossip seemed fascinating in comparison.
Because Anguin was actually his great-grandfather, a bit of a tyrant. They called him the Black Duke for all the 17 years he reigned. One reason why they probably named him Anguin was to keep him from being associated with the ancestor who had half his family killed, particularly considering he's missing most of his family himself. They call him the Orphan Duke in Alshar now, when they speak of him at all.
Oh, no wonder he looks bitter. That was an understatement. 3 years ago, when the lad was just a boy. He had been raised in the lap of luxury as sole male heir to one of the great political dynasties that ruled the Five Duchies. Then war had broken out against the goblins in the farthest reaches of his lands, and his father had been assassinated. Died as a result of wounds suffered in battle, was the official explanation, by his brother-in-law. His mother had been assassinated in her palace by agents of his aunt, and his duchy was racked by rebellion in the wealthy south. Worse, for him, was the fact that his aunt and uncle had then taken him virtual prisoner for his own safety, before crowning themselves king and queen of their combined realm. Since those eventful days, he had been living in exile in a well-appointed monastic estate somewhere in Castal, where he had been kept by his aunt and uncle, the king and queen now adorning the dais, as a hostage, or a political peace, or both. Luckily for him, his aunt, Queen Grendine, wasn't more bloodthirsty than she had to be. The tacit understanding was that as soon as her son was safely wed, and an heir to the heir was firmly implanted in his bride's tummy, Queen Grendine would see the danger of him stirring up rebellion, or worse, his being used by the lords already in rebellion as a puppet, as largely past. At that point he would be free. As long as he remained her loyal puppet, he would be free to return to what was left of loyal Alshar. That wasn't much these days. While the Alshari wilderlands are expansive, they're also very lightly populated, even before the goblins hashed it up. What people remained in the once prosperous Alshari wilderlands were mostly prisoners, soldiers, or refugees. Alshar was where the stagnant front line in the war against the non-human Gervani had settled. The occupied and contested Penumbra lands now took up a goodly portion of northern and western Alshar. About half of the devastated province remained nominally under human control. Anguin's nominal control. Historically speaking, I knew that was laughable. The seat of a duchy's power lay in its strong mercantile southlands, a stretch of coastline and coastal valleys that had been the basis of Alshari economic strength and political power for centuries. In fact, the Alshari wilderlands were rarely accounted part of the realm, in terms of relative importance of the south. The sea lords, coast lords, and vale lords of Alshar barely realized that the Alshari wilderlords of the north were their countrymen. So when the entire southern region had refused to accept the Duke of Castal as their new king, and objected, losing the wilderlands to the usurper was a small price to pay for them. The five counts who were ruling Alshar now were fighting for power among themselves, but they were united in their opposition to King Rad, no matter how he tried to persuade them. The countries there had thrown out every one of King Rad's official representatives, some without their heads. That didn't leave much of Alshar left for the forcibly loyal orphan duke. Once his political importance declined, after this wedding, he was heir to a couple of baronies of rugged farmland, a whole lot of timber, and tens of thousands of starving refugees. I'd be pissed, too. As legacies go, it was disappointing. So who is that priest who keeps whispering to him? That's Landfather Amos, High Priest of Huin, and traditional chaplain to the Alshari ducal family. He joined the lad in exile when he could. He's very devoted to the ducal house, but he's personally devoted to Anguin and his two sisters. Why?
Just trying to see who the players are at court, like you advised me.
He's hardly a player, Min, she corrected. He's a piece, a minor one, and one that's about to become useless.
To the royal family, perhaps, but not necessarily to us.
Min, after this ceremony he's going to inherit a broken duchy in deepest turmoil, one with no tax revenue for the last 3 years, no infrastructure, and no resources outside of trees and rocks. He's absolutely screwed. I pity him, but he's in no position to be a help to us.
I was thinking perhaps we could be of help to him. I could hear her mental groan.
Min, why? Don't we have enough on our table as it is?
Pen,
When you have too many problems, the path of wisdom dictates that you use them to solve each other. I've got problems of my own. I'm going to have to meet with their majesties after this party and explain why I appropriated a goodly portion of the kingdom's magical assets and embarked on a private mission with no immediate value to the security of the kingdom.
Min, you defeated 100,000 goblins that would have terrorized all the Westlands.
I know that, and that's how I'll explain it to them. But we both know how that will go. Even Count Salgo is getting chewed out for his role in the Amphatiel adventure. He pissed off a lot of field commanders and lied to some people to give us the cover to deploy. It's going to have consequences. There are those who want to see him booted from the cabinet and replaced with a more docile warlord.
I'm sure you'll muddle through, and so will Count Salgo. You managed to arrange for the pretty Prince Heir to lead a victorious battle over our foes and secure his position as a great leader of men,
she reminded me, sarcastically. I tried my best not to let my true feelings be seen on my face. People were watching. Smile. Prince Tavard had indeed led an army against our foes and gloriously fought them until they pressed for terms on the battlefield. The fact that they were already in retreat, that they were reserves and support troops, and that they were by far the smallest army fighting against the kingdom that day, were conveniently left out of the popular accounts. The prince had saved the kingdom. He was a most puissant and valiant knight, valorous and furious on the field, merciful and wise in victory. He would make a noble, wise, and just monarch when he eventually came to the throne. The minstrels said so. The truth was, I just didn't like the arrogant, narcissistic little prick. The fact that he looked far more like his murdering bitch of a mother than his insanely ambitious father may have had something to do with it. He wasn't really stupid, but Tavard did have a far too high opinion of himself. Marrying the beautiful daughter of one of the leading Remeran mercantile trading houses, the Remeran nobility don't have the same disdain for mere commerce that the Castali and Al-Shari have. Most Remeran great houses had substantial commercial interests. Certainly didn't slow down his ego. Princess Armandro was already showing signs of the new heir in her belly. That's likely to be the only thing that will save both of us from getting kicked out of court altogether. I don't foresee rosy relations between the Arcane Orders and the current regime, I answered diplomatically. Remeran commercial interests are waxing in importance at court. The fortunes of heroic war magi are in decline, now that the war is at a standstill.
We have a treaty,
she reminded me. We have a treaty, I repeated sardonically. That had become a kind of code between the high magi, at least the ones in the inner circle of the Arcane Orders. The fact was, the treaty that the Prince Heir forced on the goblins and their human confederates at Swordpoint extracted no real concessions. It wasn't enforceable, and it in no way would keep the goblin hordes from pursuing war with humanity, and every high mage knew it. It was a hollow treaty that had put the goblins at an advantage. Now they weren't mere invaders, they were a political entity with representation at court. They stuck a crown on a goblin and pretended like he was a real king. There was even talk of an embassy. We had a treaty. That wouldn't stop the genocidal hordes or their dark master. We could play diplomacy all we liked, but the ruthless ambition of the undead goblin who really ruled the Gavanni was to see every human on Kalador wiped out. Waving a treaty under his unseeing eyes wasn't going to deter him. It did, however, bring a lot of security to a troubled kingdom, and I couldn't argue against the utility of that. We had battled the goblins to a standstill, and thanks to a massive effort, some unlikely allies, and some really classy magic, we had eliminated the largest portion of their great army. Though it was a hollow victory compared to the cost, it had been a dramatic setback for the goblins. Losing his finest troops in one stroke had seriously curtailed Sherul's war plans, and we could, perhaps, take advantage of that to rebuild our own strength. If the king wanted to pretend this was peacetime, I was willing to play along with that. For now. But it wasn't peacetime. It was merely another portion of the game. As badly as I wanted to see the threat of the Gavani abated, I was a good enough strategist to understand that when the game gives you a gift of time, you capitalize on it with everything you've got. That would also inevitably put me at odds with the royal family. King Rard and Queen Grendine were still stitching together the institutions of a kingdom and consolidating their power. That's what this ridiculous and purposefully ostentatious occasion was really about, establishing their dynastic rule in the minds of everyone. The greater nobility, the lesser nobility, the clergy, the mercantile interests, and of course the commoners, upon whom everything depended, all had to recognize the power and authority of House Bimin, lest more rebellion break out. With their affairs in such a precarious state, they would not look favorably on a spellmonger mucking around with politics and such. The Magi had done our part to put them on the throne. They were done with us, for now. The Magi star was declining at court, while other constellations formed. So, I needed allies. I had a few already within the kingdom. Mage lords had begun to prosper, now that Magi could legally own lands and titles. I'd done my best to cultivate loyalty among them, as well as the rank-and-file common Magi. But that was a minor power block, at best, in the political landscape of the former five duchies. Beyond that, I had a few mercenary allies I could hire. I had my alliance with Count Salgo, whose fortunes as a war leader were declining at court, now that there was a peace treaty, and some regional allies back home in Sevendor. The arcane orders had been of use to the royal house, but now that we weren't needed any more, we were destined to become a problem for them, as Penny had explained to me over and over again. Our best bet was to lay low, practice our arts quietly, and wait until conditions were more favorable. Allow our own institutions to mature, as she said, not make trouble for larger powers before we were able to contend with them. That's what the game dictated. I was content with that, for now. I really did have my hands full, but I also had started to develop a sensitivity to political matters, not a bad thing in a landed baron, and I knew that in this game, developing allies when you were in a position of strength could pay serious dividends down the river. The royal house was just the ducal house of Castal, the heart of the new kingdom of Castalshah. If Rard was developing allies amongst the Remirans, then the Alshari made a logical counterpoint. Yes, they were weak, disorganized, and fractured, but that looked like an opportunity to me. "Pen, I want you to do something," I decided. "I want you to get to know the Alshari Duke. Get to know him. Seduce him," she asked, curious. "No, well, not if you can help it." "Good." That gave me pause. The relief in her mental voice was significant. The day that Penny turned down an opportunity to add a seated duke to her list of sexual conquests was the day that there was something seriously wrong with Lady Pentandra of Fair Oaks. And there was something wrong with Lady Pentandra of Fair Oaks, despite the fact that she was the leading authority on sex magic, a highly controversial and obscure topic even among Magi, and a confirmed libertine. Pentandra was in love. My cool, calculating friend, who had prided herself on her objective explorations of her chosen topic, had fallen as hard as an adolescent schoolgirl. No mere duke, however young and promising, was tempting her libidinous nature. The poor bastard's name was Arborn. He was the captain of the Kasari Rangers, a wilderland culture that was as rustic as Pentandra's Remiran forebears were decadently sophisticated. I couldn't fault her choice. During last year's war, Arborn had proven himself an adept leader of men, and his 1,000-strong force of Kasari Rangers had been instrumental in how the battle had unfolded. They had followed me deep into enemy territory, into the heart of the dark evil that infected the far-off Mindans, and they had fought valiantly, Arborn most courageously of them all.
He was the kind of man who makes every man in the room want to aspire to be like him. Arbonne was the kind of man who is utterly competent at everything he does, always in control, always acting with absolute certainty. It was disconcerting sometimes to see how effortlessly he adapted to any situation. In my view, he epitomized the noble savages of the Kasari tribesmen, the strange forest-loving barbarians, who were the subject of so much suspicion among the wilderfolk. He was a ferocious warrior, but he did not make war for a living. He was a masterful leader who had no ambitions of power. Unencumbered by title or lands, he nonetheless commanded universal respect among his own people. Unfortunately, in Pentandra's world, that made him a pauper, which was one reason why Penny was so damn smitten with him. Money meant nothing to him. He wanted no lands to rule. He had no use for meaningless titles. His status derived from the respect his complete competence commanded. Arbonne was a real man in a world full of base pretenders, myself included. And in the face of that kind of raw masculinity, Pentandra's pretensions to sophistication went into the creek. She wanted Arbonne bad. The problem was that, according to Arbonne's unique culture, he couldn't even consider her as a mate until she undertook a series of obscure rites deep in the Castali wilderlands. While Pentandra was intrigued from a professional standpoint, she was also hesitant about the idea. But her reaction to the prospect of seducing a young, potentially powerful duke told me volumes. Penny was attracted to Arbonne beyond reasonable limits. This hat to be love. Just make an overture. Get to know him. Let him know that there are those sympathetic to his situation. Don't promise him anything, but let him know someone is paying attention. But why are we paying attention? I can think of 30 people in this room it would be more productive for us to cultivate. The Ramirans, the Wenchari, the Gilmoran Barons, the Coast Lord Counts, the Sea Lords, the Merchant Guild Masters, the bureaucrats, the High Priests and Abbesses and assorted clergy infesting the place. Guardsmen, of everyone in the room, you think Angwen of Alshar, the Orphan Duke, is a wise move? It's a seemingly inconsequential move that may have strategic value in the future. Call it intuition.
If you say so, Min,
she said doubtfully, after a long pause. I think we'd be better off cultivating the Gavani ambassador, but if we're losing favor in court right now, then courting the trading houses is just going to make us look desperate. And we're not. We're actually in a pretty strong position. We don't need to be under Rard's eye, and the Order has a lot of dealings in his duchy.
Min, he hasn't set foot in his duchy in 3 years.
Exactly, I countered. No one has paid that poor lad the slightest bit of attention, unless it's to measure his throat for a dagger. No one really cares that he's the rightful heir to a broken duchy.
So, again, why do we care?
We care because we might need a duke some day. Angwin's father was an idiot, but he wasn't evil. He just got in his sister's way. I've heard the boy is intelligent. Some day he's going to consider claiming his throne. When he does, I'd like him to be well disposed to us. Besides, if we're going to march a couple of thousand Kasari children through his duchy, he might want to know about it. That was a subject nearer and dearer to her heart, and one far more likely to convince her than mere political expediency. A few months earlier, in the middle of the Gilmoran campaign, the kingdom made a deal, through one of its high ministers, myself, Baron Minolan of Sevendor, called a spellmonger, Marshal of Alshar, with the best rangers in the kingdom to come and scout and fight against the Gavani. But the Kasari don't love gold. In exchange for paying a basic rate for their services, part of the deal was that I find a way to transport a few thousand Kasari children from the far edge of a war zone to the safety of their main refuges, several hundred miles to the east. It seemed an impossible task. The Kasari strongholds in the northern reaches of Alshar were on the other side of the penumbra.
essentially behind enemy lines. Between their threatened homes and promised safety were several thousands of Gavani and 1,000 miles of hard travel. But the Kasari wanted their children evacuated. They were fighting a continuous border war with the goblins nearest their lands, keeping the tribal Gavani, who had settled the hills after their conquest, from moving any further north, and they knew the danger to their children if they remained. The Kasari of Bransi, as the remote settlement was known, were unwilling to yield their sacred groves to the goblins any more than they had been willing to yield to the Narasi wilderlords who tried to claim them 2 generations before. But they didn't want their children to grow up in a war zone, not when there was safe refuge available. So, as part of the deal I'd brokered, the Arcane Orders, me in particular, had pledged to escort the bulk of the Kasari children to their main homelands in northern Castal, the region known as the Kasar March. Kasar was the heart of the Kasari people. They had plenty of room in their wilderness encampments for a few thousand of their kindred's children. All I had to do now was figure out how, exactly, I was going to do that. It was a challenging problem. The Kasari are renowned for their competency and even their children can fight. But dragging 2,000 children across a war zone was bound to attract the wrong sort of attention from the Gavani. The goblins, which is what the common folk usually called the Gavani, the short, hairy, nocturnal non-humans, more politely called mountain folk or Casa de Lane in Middle Perwanese, are more rudely Scruggs, had invaded and occupied a goodly portion of the northwestern Alshari wilderlands, which they considered their ancestral homelands. Their newly claimed territory ranged for hundreds of miles out from the magically defined circle of perpetual twilight known as the Umbra, the center of which lived, metaphorically speaking, their undead leader, Shirul, the dead god. To the Gavani's elite priesthood, humanity was mere fodder for the sacrificial rock that fed their vile overlord magical power, and then literally fodder for the hordes of Gavani warriors in the penumbra. The priests had cultivated a taste for human flesh in their minions. That made prisoners taken in the war especially important. So, marching 2,000 potential human sacrifices close to the heart of the occupation zone was going to be risky, under the best of circumstances. Securing permission from the nominal overlord of the region was just the ostensible first step in the process, but an important one, because the Gavani weren't my only concern. There was the issue of human politics to consider. Bransi Mountain is in the broken duchy of Alshar. Kasar is in the very intact duchy of Castal to the east. And while the king had officially given his blessing to resettling the hundreds of thousands of poor Wilderlands refugees who had fled the invasion in more secure areas of the kingdom, the Duke of Castal, his son and heir, Tavard, had been pursuing an unofficial policy of turning common refugees away at his frontier. Compounding that challenge was the cultural bias my people had against the Kasari. The Kasari are not, racially or culturally, Narasi. They lived in the remote forests of the wilderlands or scattered tribal lands, long before either the imperial settlers of the Majocracy or their barbarian Narasi conquerors arrived. They had been there as long as the most ancient trees, according to their own legends. They had vigorously defended their groves against the Wenshari first, and then the Majocracy, and then again against the Narasi lords who saw the forest as a source of revenue, and the Kasari as pesky insurgents. The Kasari resisted forcefully every attempt to conquer them, and eventually even the Narasi lords gave up trying. Once the Kasari established their relative independence, agreeing to token tribute and nominal cooperation with their ostensible overlords, things in the wilderlands settled down. But the Narasi common folk generally had a poor opinion of the drably dressed Kasari wanderers, who they saw as little more than shiftless vagabonds, wandering rope merchants who refused to till or serve, like proper wilderfolk. An army of vagabonds, however youthful, was bound to stir up some ill feelings along the way, especially once we reached the Castali frontier. If we reached the Castali frontier. The good thing about the entire enterprise, however, was that it kept Pentandra completely invested in the idea for a while. Since this was so important to Captain Arborn, it was important to her. She was trying to impress him with her assistance. Pentandra was willing to do anything that would help the Kasari quest because it furthered her own quest to become the handsome ranger's bride.
If it helps the evacuation, I suppose I could speak to the Orphan Duke, she told me, as I suspected she would. I'll go and see him this evening. Something tells me he's not going to want to wait around the reception too long.
I stared at the arrogant little prick who was destined to rule us some day, as he promised to faithfully cherish the life force of his bride, or some ornate crap like that. He looked like he was the center of the universe. His vapid little bride, Ishi, bless her pretty little heart, was staring at him with slavish adoration. No, I don't think Duke Anguin is going to appreciate his cousin's success tonight. Speak with his priest, and set up an audience. I have to meet with the Royal Court Wizard directly after the ceremony anyway, so I'll miss the first part of the reception.
Master Hartarian? Why?
Because Mavone contacted me this morning, mind to mind. He got word from one of his contacts in Merwin. The remnants of the Censorate of Magic have congressed and reformed under the auspices of the Duke of Merwin. They are meeting at Nablus to re-establish the order. There weren't a lot of details yet, but it looks like he's giving them the backing they need to prosecute an extended war against the Arcane Orders.
Oh, men.
Pentandra sighed sadly.
I did hope they would all just go away.
That's what happens when you institutionalize fanaticism, I observed. When the purpose is gone, you have a bunch of fanatics wandering around with nothing to do. Merwin gave them something to do. All I know for now is that he has authorized their exclusive use of witch stones in his duchy, given them complete control of magic, and they've changed their livery.
Their livery?
Their cloaks are now red and white checks, not black and white checks.
That sounds ominous. And what witch stones?
That's what I need to speak with Hartarian about. Since he's the former Censor General, he should know exactly how many the Censorate had confiscated in their armories. Mavone wasn't able to figure out more than a few.
I don't like the sound of that, Min.
Neither will good King Rad, hopefully, because I'm going to use this new development as leverage if I need to. Having his greatest foreign rival suddenly accumulate a magical core of fanatics isn't going to bode well for his future international relations. His only counter to it is a much stronger magical core on his side.
Well, we're stronger,
admitted Pentandra worriedly.
But, Min, they're censorates, war magi.
I know. That means that they will be well-disciplined, well-funded, and absolutely ruthless. Whereas we're undisciplined, haphazardly funded, and completely focused on the penumbra. But this means we're going to have to spare some attention to events in the East, eventually. I'll know just how soon eventually is after I speak to Hartarian.
Which is a convenient excuse to skip the post-ceremony blessings,
she complained.
You know I'll have to be there in your stead if you're otherwise occupied.
I thought celebration of nuptials at the highest levels of society would be an intriguing opportunity for observation for an established sex magic researcher such as you, I joked.
It would be one thing if they were going to rut in the middle of the feast like peasants. The bride is comely and young, and the groom is pleasant enough to look at, as long as he doesn't open his mouth. I'd anticipate a lusty performance, but royal propriety demands the ceremonial defloration occur in the chamber, despite the fact that the entire court knows he's been doing her regularly since they first met in Rhaemir, and she has a baby in her belly already. So, I get to stand around and sip wine, and listen to a bunch of priestesses chant, until some flunky waves a fake bloody sheet around and we all cheer.
Yes,
what a fortunate opportunity for expanding my research.
I stifled the laugh. I was still supposed to be smiling serenely and paying attention to the new princess, pledging her undying love and devotion to her husband. But the sound in Penny's mental voice told me all I needed to know.
Oh, Pen, it's been a while for you, hasn't it?
My social life is none of your concern, she snapped.
Then a moment later she continued in a gentler tone.
And yes, it has been a while. Almost 6 months, actually.
I'm afraid my eyes bulged more than was appropriate during the bride's declaration that she had known no man's touch, loved no man's heart, and was free from wickedness, which was unfortunate timing. A couple of monks looked at me and made disapproving faces.
6 months? Ishi's... Oh, Pen, why? You have a dozen hunky lads running around your estate? I figured you'd be exercising twice a day, thrice on festival days.
That was the plan, she admitted, and I would never tell anyone else this, and will find a fiendishly clever way to punish you if it ever got out. But since I met Arborn, my muscular servants just don't...
Kindle your hearth?
Float your barge? Get your bread baked? Put the curl in your slippers?
Min, I have a witch stone,
she reminded me. I'm not above laying waste to the entire room if I get grouchy. She said it in a joking manner that told me she wasn't really joking.
But no,
my servants aren't even a sufficient distraction. I gave up on them, as nice a bunch of lads as they are. I just can't look at another man without comparing him unfavourably to Arborn.
I understand, Pen, I said, reassuringly.
No, you really don't, she shot back. It's not your fault. You are a man. You don't understand how women love. You only have a vague idea of how men love.
I do, from an academic level. I understand what's going on with me in ways you just cannot fathom. That's what makes it worse. For all of my studies in sex magic and human mating, to discover that I am just as subject to the capricious whims of Ishi's damnable blessings as any empty-headed peasant slut is humiliating in a way. But I am, and I have to contend with that. And what comes after?
That's terrible, Penny.
Right now, I'm in a period of emotional isolation, constantly comparing every man I meet to the ideal Arborn represents, even you. Yet every comparison increases the desire I feel for him, and I intuitively resent any woman enjoying the fulfillment of a sexual relationship right now. That is strongly colouring my perspective.
That's a humbling admission, Penny, I replied thoughtfully. That can't be easy for you.
It isn't. It's only because you're you, and I trust you, and you know me, and we're in the intimate privacy of our own heads that I can ever even admit this to myself. But, Min, I feel like the most accomplished magical physician in the world, watching himself waste away from a disease, knowing in gruesome detail what is happening to his body every moment he descends toward his ultimate demise.
Gosh, Penny, you make love sound so romantic.
Love is about the least romantic thing around, she snapped again. It's horribly messy, complicated and compromising, and it's utterly uncontrollable. We paint it with legend and romance and myth and elevate the idealized realization of it to divine levels, because otherwise the pain and misery of it would eclipse the rare glimpses of joy. We'd slit each other's throats in horror in the middle of the night and never have children. Romance protects the heart and the species, but it's a hollow mockery, a necessary deception we all agree upon to fool each other into continuing to do it.
Perhaps your academic study has skewed your perspective, I answered gently. Also, you really, really need to get laid.
You think?
Chapter 2 The Orphan Duke. I didn't have a lot of time or energy to devote to the Kasari March for a while, as I was deeply involved in that most sinister of institutions, royal court politics. My own position was uniquely secure, of course, thanks to my witch sphere, the apple-sized, perfect sphere of Irionite that followed me around like a faithful hound most places. I was the head of the arcane orders, a member of the royal court by default, until I decided not to be, or until someone was powerful enough to take my sphere away from me. There were a lot of changes going on as the nascent royal court evolved. Ministers initially appointed for their symbolic value or strategic importance were quietly replaced with more career-minded bureaucrats. In most cases, that wasn't a big issue. Who cares who the Minister for Maritime Trade is, or the Royal Architect, or the Minister of Tolls, Tariffs, and Tribute? Come to find out, a lot of people cared. People in my profession. Between sorting out who was incoming and who was outgoing, meeting them and hearing their various policy positions, and pretending I was actually interested, I had a lot to do. And that didn't even cover my unofficial but more important reason for my presence at court. I had to defend my actions in Gilmore in front of their majesties, in private session. That could have gone better. The end result of our four-hour-long meeting at His Majesty's hunting lodge, a sprawling manor 20 miles from the capital where he intended to build his new palace, was that I was to stop all of this silly antagonistic talk about pressing the war with the Gavanni, with whom we now had a treaty their majesties did not want to imperil. Instead, I was instructed, with the force of a royal decree, I was to merely focus my magical efforts exclusively on shoring up the defences, both magical and mundane, around the penumbra, to prevent any more unpleasantness from disrupting the kingdom's commerce. My appropriation of a goodly portion of the former Second Royal Commando was lightly glossed over. The remnant of men who had taken the king's coin and then been routed on the field was of little consequence in hindsight. The loyal First Royal Commando was now transitioning to become the new Royal Guard, while the less savoury Third Commando had been demobilised. Still in the field in Gilmore, they were now reforming themselves as a mercenary unit under an elected leader, and entertaining bids for employment. Leading the bulk of the kingdom's magical corps away from their duty to protect the kingdom was a more serious matter, in their majesties' opinion. When I countered that the result of the sudden, surprise redeployment had been the destruction of a massively superior force at little cost to the kingdom, they were somewhat mollified. But not much. I was sent away with the strong admonition to continue my good and dutiful service to the crown only and exclusively in a defensive manner, it was emphasized. Let's just say it was a spirited debate. I could not argue that military attention to the region wasn't needed. It was, desperately. But it seemed a minor issue compared to the incipient, fanatical goblin state evolving on our borders, under the auspices of a puppet goblin king. While our opinions differed, they were resolute. Finally, I agreed. I would shore up the penumbra's defences, and that was it. They even threw money at me for it, 5,000 ounces of gold, for the purpose of erecting a series of modest towers and outposts along the northeastern section of the penumbra. That was a victory of sorts. That entire region was depopulated, and the few Wilderlords there were busy fighting for their lives on a daily basis. Most of the primitive castles in the Wilderlands had fallen, or were occupied now, and none of them reflected the defensive reality the province faced. We all agreed that an organized, permanent presence in the region was essential. You couldn't have an iron band around the neck of the goblins, as Rad pledged at his coronation, unless the band went all the way around. The peeled towers I envisioned were designed to act more as watchtowers than military fortifications. They would be strengthened by magic and would be able to withstand a light assault, or even a siege. But they were less fortresses and more outposts. Peeled towers usually consisted of the sparest of enclosures for defence, usually an uncrenellated wall around a few elevated acres, with a single tower or keep inside. In some places, an additional hall was added for comfort. It's a very basic, unsophisticated fortification, the kind popular in poor or marginal areas. It was as basic a structure that you could get away with calling a castle without people snickering. The tower gave you enough elevation to see someone coming and shoot over the walls, and the walls were thick enough to keep out bandits or raiders, but not much else. Compared to the Mott and Bailey Fortress, traditionally popular in the Wilderlands, these were lightweight defences. small enough to build for around 1,000 ounces of gold each, say. That sounds like a lot, but I had to spread it around in several different directions, and it wasn't going to be nearly enough, I was pretty certain. Not in that remote location. But it was one of the few things I could get Rad and Grendine to agree with me on, and I could use that commission as a pretext to do a lot of other stuff I wanted without mentioning it to anyone in particular. And it was going to be expensive. I was going to have to raise more from somewhere, I was pretty certain. But it was a start. Despite the acrimony of the audience, they essentially gave me everything I wanted them to, while thinking that they chastised me and put me in my place. It was a brutal exercise in the politics of power at the highest levels. Threats and compliments were exchanged in profusion. We parted with certain understandings. It was all a little surreal. But I came out smiling to myself. I had all the mandate I needed. Soon after that uncomfortable meeting, Pentandra contacted me about her assignment.
His Grace, Duke Anguin III of Alshar, is willing to grant you an audience, she dutifully reported mind to mind when we had the mutual opportunity to speak. Actually, this kid Anguin is willing to talk to you. The distinction is important. He knows intellectually that he's the sovereign duke of a sizable realm, but he hasn't been let out of sight of his bodyguards for 3 years, so it hasn't really sunk in.
But he'll talk to us.
He'll talk to you, she emphasized, largely on the recommendation of Master Thinrattle.
The former ducal court wizard of Alshar had not gotten along well with the young duke's sire, but apparently the lad trusted the man's opinion, possibly because he hadn't gotten along with his ill-fated father. The Alshari court had been notoriously full of obsequious courtiers. It made the Castali court seem businesslike by comparison. Thinrattle had been one of the few who wasn't an arse-kisser of royal proportions. I arranged to visit with the orphan duke quietly the next evening. He was staying in a small but well-appointed monastic estate a few miles outside of town, one of the many who supplemented their endowment by renting out their halls to important nobles. Pentandra and I went by ourselves, dressed in plain robes that could easily be mistaken for clerical garb, ecclesiastic hoods over our faces. No doubt we were followed. The kingdom's spies were everywhere, but we tried not to attract undue attention anyway. We were escorted into a small hall within the bounds of the monastery and up to a wooden tower room. There the young duke sat in a chair by the fire, the old priest near his shoulder.
Your Grace,
I said, bowing low, after we'd been announced by a page. I knew and admired your father, I said as graciously as I could. It was my honour to be knighted by him the night he died.
So I hear, the young duke said without preliminaries. I hear a lot of things about you, Spellmonger.
As do I, Your Grace. Not a few of them are untrue. That raised a smirk on the lad's lips.
So what business does the mighty Spellmonger have with me?
He asked, with a bit of disinterest in his voice. I wish to be of service to you, sire, I began. His eyes immediately shot to me.
When people tell me that,
he said slowly, it usually means they want to use me somehow.
Oh, I do, Your Grace, I assured him. I want to use you to restore Northern Alshar, or at least a bit of it. You're ready to take the fight to the dead god, then?
He asked, his voice rising just a bit higher than he'd intended.
Not yet, Your Grace,
I admitted sadly, as Penny and I were offered seats by the initiates who doubled as servants here. In fact, it may be that we never face Sherul directly, not in our lifetimes. But while I cannot deliver all of your lands, I might be able to preserve some of your people, and in the process, bring some security and stability to your lands outside of the Penumbra.
My lands, he snorted bitterly, my people. Lands I haven't been given, people I've never seen. My Lord Spellmonger, perhaps you have yet to notice, but I am no longer at liberty to travel to the lands to rule over these people. I am a duke in name only, he said with resignation. You can thank my aunt, my uncle, and my idiotic cousins for that.
What if your freedom could be arranged? I offered. I knew already that Queen Grendine was about to allow the boy to return home to one of his Gilmoran estates, or anywhere else except the rebellious portions of Alshar. She expected him to elect to remain in Castabriel, ruling his broken lands from afar by proxy, living off his stipend amid the noble whores and scheming aristocrats of the capital city. That's what any reasonable young noble might do in Anguin's situation. But the prospect did not apparently suit the orphan duke.
You could get me out of this. You could return me home.
In time, I agreed. For now I could put you at liberty. That I would do regardless. But it occurs to me, Your Grace, I said, borrowing one of my castellan's favourite expressions, that if one wishes to be treated as a sitting duke, then one should endeavour to act as a sitting and independent-minded duke. That got the lad's and his priestly mentor's attention.
Would the mage lord wish to expound upon this proposal? Asked Landfather Amos in a deep voice.
The Cassari, Your Grace. I nodded. Though they barely acknowledge your authority over them, nonetheless they are the most populous and best organized humans left in the wilderlands.
So, the Cassari are not loyal. They are rebellious barbarians. It is well known. I've heard it from my late father's own lips for years.
The Cassari are not loyal to the ducal house, I corrected. That does not mean that they know no loyalty. On the contrary, they are highly loyal to those who are themselves loyal to the Cassari. A great many of them in the far northern groves wish to send their children out of harm's way, so that they can help fight this war. This they will do with your leave or without it.
So why bother asking for permission?
Or granting it, for that matter? The lad asked astutely, as a servant poured us wine. Because if the Cassari are moved with your blessing and by your command, I suggested, and they know that their welfare is your desire, then you have earned such honour as to begin to command their loyalty. Perhaps, sire, the Cassari have never been particularly loyal to the Alshari ducal house, because the Alshari ducal house has rarely been concerned with the welfare of the Cassari. He paused and considered, looking to the priest for guidance. Then he looked back at me.
Perhaps you are correct. Still, will the Cassari fight for me? Help me retake my lands?
Unlikely, Your Grace, yet having their allegiance could prove very important some day. So, by giving us leave and blessing to lead them thus, as legitimate subjects of your realm, worthy of your protection, you are legitimizing your reign over them. More importantly, the Cassari will feel loyal to you, personally, and while they may not be able to retake your lost lands, they are nearly the only organized human resistance remaining north of the Penumbra. You will not reconquer those provinces without their aid.
You speak of conquest, when I don't even have my own sword,
Anguin complained, bitterly but philosophically. The words of someone who has accepted their exile with stoic resentment.
Nor castles, armies, or knights of my own. On the contrary, Your Grace,
Pentandro pointed out,
you are the heir to an impressive estate, in addition to your title and position. I had my clerks research into it, and you have inherited dozens of estates and domains in Alshar, here in Castal, and even in Ramir on your mother's side. You have the right to call upon any of them for military service, if you so require. Yet would they respond to that call?
He challenged. I have been kept in seclusion from my own people since my parents died. My father always said it required more than mere obligation to summon a man to war. It required personal loyalty. A loyalty I have been prohibited by circumstance from developing. I was not squire to the household of a high noble, and allowed to cultivate friends and allies who would in turn come to my banners. I was surrounded by monks and scrolls and books, with a few lessons in swordplay and horsemanship.
Yet you are a seated duke, Your Grace,
reminded Father Amos. Rad made certain of that before he had you agree to that damnable vote that put the broken crown on his head.
King Rad,
I said, emphasizing the title quickly and forcefully. Always, Father, even in your thoughts and prayers,
That fact alone is why the Duke is alive today. Any hint of disloyalty to that thought could prove deadly or disastrous. But you are correct. He is a seated Duke, granted his full rights at his majority and investiture by his brother Dukes on the Coronet Council. Therefore, there should be no legal impediment to him assuming his authority over his own realm. This permission to lead the Kasari children out of danger establishes that precedent in a way that your political opponents will not see as threatening as another course of action. Say if you started asking all of your nobles how many armed men they might send to your banner.
That is a fair point, conceded Anguin. I could tell that thinking in such terms was a novelty for the young nobleman. But he had already mastered the courtier's art of understanding the dangers of the game.
If I am Duke enough to allow this evacuation, then I am Duke enough to reclaim my legacy, he reasoned, and this manner of exerting my sovereignty, in a far-off region of the realm, will be of little concern to those who look elsewhere for foes.
The treachery of your enemies is well known, sire, agreed Father Amos, gravely. I agree with the spellmonger's counsel. Such a small exercise in your authority is unlikely to raise the interest or the ire of those who watch you. It can be explained as a humanitarian gesture, a token of your benevolence, and a gesture of gratitude to the gods for their favour. But it does establish your right to do as you please within your own realm, even if you yourself are not permitted to go there.
Yet, I reminded, nor is Alshar yet prepared for your return, your grace. Coming home prematurely, and without adequate regard for those whose interests are based on your absence, invites treachery from different directions. As fast as you are growing into the role, you are not yet ready to administer to your duchy properly. That requires an army, a court, a judiciary, things that rebellion and interregnum have swept away in Alshar.
But the time will come,
Duke Anguin said, setting his jaw defiantly. There was a smoldering look in his eyes, passion, mostly. Some of that passion was hatred toward his benefactors, but there was a lot more to the lad than mere vengeance. He was an intelligent young man, well-educated and prepared to rule, yet whose native enthusiasm for that task had been frustrated by his unfortunate exile. Anguin wanted desperately to do something, I realized. Anything. Anything that made him matter. I homed in on that desire like a scheming courtier. The Kasari have none to stand and protect them, your grace. They are used to fending for themselves, but the challenge they face is daunting. Yet they alone have maintained control over their lands, though they are on the very threshold of shadow. They have withstood the invasion, where your father's wilderlords and professional knights were swept away. As allies, the Kasari may lack for prestige in the halls of the powerful, but in the wilderness of your realm, their mastery is unmatched. Grant them your permission, your protection, and your provision, and you will extend a hand to a folk unused to such displays.
The wizard speaks with wisdom, the old priest chuckled. And in favour to your interests, your grace.
Yet while I applaud your concern for Duke Anguin's legacy, spellmonger, we have become wary of those who seem to selfishly serve the Duke, yet conceal their own purposes. What would you have of his grace in return for this permission?
Influence, Pentandra said instantly. We understand that the House of Terrine is at a low point at the moment. When, God's willing, the fortunes of your grace wax. We wish to have the access and understanding of your grace in our affairs. A strong House of Terrine would be a boon to the arcane orders in the current climate. We feel strongly enough about that to invest our aid in the effort to strengthen your position, even at the risk of our own favour at the royal court.
Yet at the moment I am still a near prisoner, Anguin said moodily. The ducal regalia and essential records were taken from Barone by King Rad, after my mother's funeral. They had to send to Wilderhall for the coronet and seal for my investiture and the coronation. It's all still there, locked away, for safe keeping, much as I am.
The ducal seal is the ducal seal because the duke makes it so, Father Amos observed. The coronet is more important, of course, but,
in my experience, Your Grace, it is not the funny hat who makes the man a leader, I said, as sagely as I could pull off. It is the man who leads who